Good evening. This is the 31st of March, 2024, and I'm back from several days I've taken off because of the important period in the Catholic faith. So what I want to do this evening is give you lecture number 8 on inflammasomes. So let's proceed. We were finishing with the Kawasaki disease, and I mentioned to you that that particular disease is most commonly diagnosed in children and has to do with the expression of the NLR family pattern recognition receptors. Here we're talking about NLRC4 and NLRP12. And of course, it's associated with the production of interleukin-1 beta, all of which are increased, all of those polypeptides I just mentioned. I then told you that the methylation levels of certain CpG islands associated either with the promoters or enhancers of those genes were much lower in leukocytes of the Kawasaki patients than in non-patients or otherwise normal and non-pathological state. Now that indicates, of course, just by using categorical logic, that hypomethylation of the gene of the inflammasome PRRs, and those proteins are the NLRC and the NLRP12, and the pro-inflammatory cytokine IL-1 beta play a regulatory role in the upregulation of the expression of those genes, which of course then directly results in the inflammatory response and pathogenesis of Kawasaki disease. So that suggests the regulatory role of DNA methyltransferase 1. And indeed, this is also the case of DNA methyltransferase 1 regulating microRNA expression and associated inflammasome activation in atherosclerosis in ApoE, that's apolipoprotein E, knockout mice. It's another example, okay? So, details. DNMT1 hypermethylated promoter of the MIR MIR, that's the microRNA 145, which essentially decreased plaque formation and consequently reduced the expression of miR-145 in the vessel, because you're hypermethylating the promoter for that microRNA, led to the activation of the NLRP3 inflammasome and subsequently the entire inflammatory response. And sequelae, including the production, as I've been saying now many times, of the status incoming initiating interleukin-1 beta status for inflammation in that ApoE knockout mice background. Now that links again, as you can tell, DNA methylation, inflammasome activation. And here we're talking about atherosclerosis. And that suggests again that perhaps targeting DNMT and maybe other components of the inflammasomes to treat atherosclerosis may be a useful consideration in some pharmacotherapeutic research studies. Okay, I'm not saying it is for sure, I'm just saying it might be useful. So, and these papers are alluding to this, right? So, obviously, this connection between DNA methylation and inflammasome activation. Where else? Well, in osteoarthritis. So, looking at osteoarthritic cells, it's been shown that there are certain C-terminal binding proteins that are overexpressed in osteoarthritic patients, which promote the activation of the NLRP3 inflammasome and, of course, all the downstream inflammation. They looked at caspase-1 activation and, of course, the maturation, because of that enzyme activity, maturation of IL-1 beta. And this was all linked to increased osteoarthritic disease in those patients. So here, the expression level of DNMT1 and DNMT3A, remember those are two methyltransferases, were lowered in OA patients. And the knockdown of either of those two methyltransferases results in hypomethylation of those proteins I just mentioned to you that are overexpressed in OA. Remember what the proteins were quickly? CTBPs. Those are C-terminal binding proteins. And that led to, because of this alteration in methylation, because of knocking down methyltransferases, right? Led to CTBP overexpression and what? NLRP3 inflammasome activation. Okay. When you had hypomethylation. And this was in human osteoarthritic patients. Okay. So yet another example, right? You get now how corrupting or decreasing the inflammasome via epigenetic modification of chromatin linked to the expression of genes that are imparting the inflammation linked to the inflammasome can be a direct correlation to diseases in humans. Okay. And I'm not going to go any deeper than that because I'm not going to suggest, like many of these papers do, because this is what they're working towards, right? They're trying to work towards some kind of therapy that any kind of small molecule drug or maybe a monoclonal antibody to any of those proteins might be beneficial pharmacotherapeutically. We just can't know that because you've by now learned in authentic biochemistry, not just because of these mosaics I'm doing, which I think are really threading the needle really well in the understanding of how the mosaic, which is a living system, functions. I really do think you're getting more out of it this way with these mosaics, although I realize they're very complicated to follow. Well, the cell and biochemical pathways are very complicated to follow, so go figure, right? But what I'm trying to say is that even though I'm making these statements, I'm giving you these clinical associations, I'm not going to go as far as to say that I would recommend a research program to be looking at targeting any of those proteins. Because you know that all of this gets resolved naturally in vivo. So if you corrupt the resolution, even if it's proximal or even if it's way distal to the final inflammatory response, which you're trying to remove, all of the upstream and all the downstream mediators in that normal regulation are going to become corrupted. Which means you may just add the emphasis on the dislocation of the control and therefore hyperinflammation by knocking out any one of its components. You understand? Because the cell obviously is getting these sorts of insults all the time. And it's not because of the pharmacotherapeutics. It's because of alterations in gene expression. And then all the energy, for example, necessary to drive all this protein synthesis. And think about all the trafficking of all the intermediates. Think about the induction of the toll-like receptors. Think about where acetylcysteamethionine is coming from as a methylating agent. Think about what happens if you have a decrease in methyltransferase activity. Where is the acetylcysteamethionine going to be used otherwise? Maybe just for protein methyltransferases. If it's in the nucleus, you see, and that protein methyltransference may well alter an entire new cavity of potential inflammation, or may not have an effect on it at all, but something else downstream, like promoting cell proliferation. So I'm not claiming that you shouldn't investigate this. I'm just trying to make it clear that I'm not advocating that this simple alteration of even something as complex as finding the regulatory components, as say the protein expression level, or let's say at the membrane lipid fluid alteration or flipase level, isn't directly linked to these diseases. I'm saying that once you start modulating any of those components, you're going to have to follow along and see what else you've done by that modulation. And I've learned all of this way back with gene knockout studies. Thinking of gene knockouts were so clean, we knock out this one gene, and then we understand, first of all, it's real function in the cell, because we look at the results of what happens when we knock it out. They say, oh, now we know, and now we challenge, say, a mouse model, a KO mouse. We say, oh, look, now they don't have this gene. They're susceptible to, you know, an oncogenic event, or they're susceptible to a lack of DNA repair, which could lead to a mutation. You know, all these kinds of potential sequelae. And what do we find? We do those knockouts, they're not as clean as we thought they were, because there's proximal and distal activities, even by knocking out one gene. Okay. All right. Now, let's go back and talk a little bit more about bacterial inflammasome paradigm and see how it deepens even more when we're talking about Staphylococcus aureus. Okay. You thought we were finished with that? Well, we almost were, but not quite. So as aureus, toxin-mediated necrotosis modifies, if you recall from lecture a couple lectures back, modifies and in fact short circuits the pyrotonic pathway. Okay? Pharmacological inhibition, indeed, of the enzyme known as MLKL, specifically dampens caspase 1 activation and the associated pyrotonic signaling in host cells upon staph stimulation, staphylococcus stimulation. And that is directly correlated, remember, with the observation that mice lacking the NLRP6 inflammasome exhibit both reduced pyrotosis and necrotosis signaling following that pathogen challenge. Remember, that's how we got to that point. However, antagonism of necrotosis, such as with the modulation of MLKL or RIPK1 or RIPK3, those are kinases, will clearly protect human and murine macrophages as well as neutrophils from methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. Yes, which you know is a problem in as a nosocomial infection in hospitals and in clinics. So, keeping with that observation, what I just told you, RIPK3 knockout, again, mouse, display increased resistance during experimental S. aureus lung infection because of the presence of anti-inflammatory CD206 positive and CD200R positive alveolar macrophages, which then accumulate because of the RIPK3 knockout in the lungs. And what those macrophages do is clear the staphylococci. You see? So indeed, blockade of the C-Jun-N terminal kinases, that's J and K1 and 2, both of which, you know, trigger what? The TNF and the tumor necrosis factor and the toll-like receptor induced necrotic cell death. Or even if you do a blockade of those two J and Ks, or even if you do a genetic ablation of the proxoproliferator activated receptor alpha, which you know is what? A ligand activated transcription factor and a suppressor of NF-kappa-B activation will rescue mice from fatal staph lung disease, even under conditions when they are doing an overload of bacterial super infection. Okay? Now remember, okay, see where I'm bringing you to. I'm showing you again how necrotosis and pyrotosis, both of which can lead to cell death and both of which can cause great damage to the tissue, right? And maybe even enhance inflammation, both of them. There is nevertheless a modulation of those two activities. So we have to look downstream at all the potential activators and inhibitors. Now, remember something else. that the inhibition of that OGG1, remember that's the oxo-DNA glycosylase, that's a base exchange repair enzyme, remember? So when you inhibit that enzyme, silencing by DNA methylation, demethylation, will suppress the NLRP3 inflammasome activation. And of course, that means the NLRP3 inflammasome-induced inflammatory response. And in that instance, what are we talking about? Not necrotosis, but pyrotosis. Now, this is what's shown in bladder muscle. Yeah, totally a different clinical system. So let's go back and put this together. We said this before. I just want to remind you because it's been a couple of days. The innate immune response substantially contributes to that microbial clearance. That can happen during infection, early stages, but it maintains a defense mechanism that can continue on, which will turn on all the other immune responses. One of them is PCD, right? Because PCD, as we've been saying, will directly impact host microbe or host pathogen interaction. And therefore, it's going to control infection rate, right? And even the pathogen replication activity. Now, remember, we talked about all the different cell death programs. Apoptosis, one of them, which is non-inflammatory. Regulated ischemic irreversible necrosis, which is necrotosis, and the regulated inflammatory microbiocidal pyrotosis, those two being highly inflammatory, yet all three, uniquely or otherwise, initiate and execute cell death. So apoptosis, remember, often what we believe that is doing initially in the immune response is it's activated to release the intracellular pathogens. It's already gotten inside a cell and infected it. And when that occurs, the host simply removes that cell, okay? Eliminates it via apoptosis. Okay, so that cell cannot replicate. Simultaneously, what else does it do? It exposes the pathogen to the extracellular milieu. What's out there? All the rest of the immune response, including the acquired immune response, right? T-MEM cells, B-MEM cells, right? Complement, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Just remember that necrotosis and pyrotosis are highly inflammatory. That's something you always have to keep in mind. And that means they're going to impact many things, not just cell death, but they're going to impact those two responses, necrotosis, pyrotosis. Trafficking of immune cells. And the trafficking and then the overactivation of those trafficked immune cells are what lead to some of the worst clinical pathophysiologies. Okay. So that should be old news, new news, right? All right. So again, a little bit more about the staff. That was just to bring you back to focus on concepts. Staph aureus triggers inflammation through inflammasome activation. We're well aware of that. First movement in that regard is the recruitment of neutrophils. And then that can be associated with pathogen clearance as well as tissue damage. So what about necrotosis? Well, we know that necrotosis is mediated by the RIPK1, RIPK3, MLKL pathway. So we know that's got to be linked to this pathophysiological pro-inflammatory response from staph infection. So what is MLKL? Just to remind you, I've talked about it before, but I know that you know, you're not looking at all your notes. That's a gene that encodes a polypeptide after transcription translation that is essentially a protein kinase, right? However, it's inactive when it's normally expressed, because it lacks several amino acid residues for activity. That's correct. So the protein will play a critical role in TNF-induced necrotosis. Now, you know, that's, you know, another, that's programmed cell death. And how does MLK do that? It's not acting as a kinase there. It's interacting with the receptor interacting protein 3. That's the RIP3. And that, of course, is a key protein in the necrotosis pathway. So when people have done inhibitor studies or just plain old knockouts of that gene, you inhibit TNF-induced necrosis. So high levels of the MLKL and RIP3 are associated with multiple clinical manifestations of a disease. One that's been looked at quite a bit is the inflammatory bowel disease in children. So in models of skin infection or even sepsis, in MLKL double knockout mice, of course, they're going to have high bacterial loads. And also they're going to have essentially an inability to limit interleukin 1 beta production. What's that going to cause? Excessive inflammation, along with high bacterial populations. Similarly, the kinases, the RIPK1, RIPK3, when you inhibit them in mice, inhibit the kinases, you're going to get increased bacterial load and sepsis. Of course, they're associated, right? So RIPK3 double knockout mice exhibit increased staph clearance and decreased inflammation. Okay. In skin and systemic infection, because of direct effects of RIPK3 on IL-1 beta production. And what is that linked to? Apoptosis. Now, contrast that to caspase knockout mice. There you get defective SRES killing and very poor outcomes in the MLKL mouse model. And what that is likely attributed to more is to phagocytic dysfunction. So that suggests that necrotic cell death limits the pathophysiological inflammatory response normally induced by SRES. That summarizes all that data. It's from a paper published in 2016. Yeah, in Cell Reports. It'll be in the show notes. Now, I'm going to check my time here. Yeah, boy, we're cooking along pretty fast. It's good. We've been a few days in a nadir of lectures, right? But for a perfectly good reason. All right. Just like immune cells, we mentioned before, keratinocytes will undergo caspase-1-mediated pyrotosis. And, of course, that's linked to IL-1 beta production. And that's in response to SRES. And that will all cause eradication of skin infections in the keratinocyte, loci. Remember, the keratinocytes follow highly regulated pattern of proliferation, maturation, and then a process called cornification, which is essentially a solidification, and cell death. And how is that functioning? Through apoptosis and necrotosis. Now, remember how this works. SRES, through its pore-forming toxins, induce the necrotosis in immune cells. The necrotosis results from the oligomerization of the MLKL, which is initiated by the RIPK3-dependent phosphorylation of RIPK1. So MLKL then forms a pore that leaks intracellular contents, and that results in the pro-inflammatory response. So just like caspase-1-mediated pyrotosis, necrotosis will also result in the release of intracellular contents, which is still going to promote inflammation just by a different means. So necrotosis and pyrotosis share multiple effectors. And some of those components include the caspase 8, the RIP kinase 1, the RIP kinase 3, all contributing to the processing and activation of interleukin 1 beta. so that both pyritosis and necrotosis generate inflammation. So that pathway that we initialized in the discussion lecture just 10 minutes ago, the pathway RIPK1, RIPK3, MLKL, that signaling pathway is activated, of course, canonically, physiologically by toll-like receptors and that TNF alpha receptor. That means you're going to have interferon alpha beta receptor mediated responses, the so-called IFNAR responses. And what that indicates in total is a close association between necrotosis and pathogen recognition because of the consequence of necrotosis not always being pro-inflammatory. So necrotosis can simply mean the elimination of cells that produce cytokines and other inflammatory agents and the release of the bacteria to be cleared by the neutrophils. And that's going to lead overall to a decrease in inflammation and the removal of the pathogen. See? So the question always is, how does necrotosis and pyritosis function together in host cells when you get an infection like Asarius? Because they both seem to be governing certain components of that signaling cascade pathway. And that means they have that some redundancy because ultimately they're signaling inflammation. And what else? I just told you, cell death. So it looks like maybe pyritosis initiates removal of the staph infection, and maybe necrotosis following serves to eliminate the cells that have caused the excessive inflammation. So you see how that works, right? All right, so staph enters the cell, turns on RIPK1. RIPK1 phosphorylates RIPK3. RIPK3 activates NLRP3, ASC caspase 1, giving you an active caspase 1, taking pro-IL-1B and generating mature interleukin 1 beta. Same time, RIP kinase 3 causes that dimerization of MLKL, which opens up a pore, causing necrotosis, which is reduced inflammation. The NLRP3 pathway and leukin 1 beta pathway I just went through is going to be the pyrototic pathway, killing the bacteria. And yet there's one more component. RIPK3 will directly activate apoptosis. So you see how all these work in a congenial way to control the staph aureus infection. And that's precisely what I've been trying to get to in these series of lectures for the last several episodes. Okay, so I'm going to stop here. I was going to do a little bit of 14,300 foot level, Pikes Peak level, organized conceptual metaphysics about this whole system, but I don't have time to do it. And I know it's going to take me at least 5 minutes. So maybe we'll start the next lecture on that. Something to look forward to. New week. This is Sunday night, so we will continue on inflammasomes for a while, though. I'm not finished with them, but not too much longer, because I've got another new topic I've been working on, of course. And it will complement the inflammasome mosaic, I think, pretty well. Like all these mosaics are complementing one another, I hope. Okay, thank you very much for listening. Hopefully you had a very good Lent and Easter weekend, and that you were ready to learn some more about inflammasomes tonight. And other than that, that you're doing well, and bye for now.